Review session for HDFS 60 on Friday, May 4th. 5th? Huh. 30 days has September, April, June, and November. All the rest have 31 except for Grandma, and she's too old to ride the range. That's part of a junior high school poem I learned. But you're sure it's the 5th? I had not reset my watch, so I've been a day behind all week. But I didn't know it. All right. The exam is Tuesday at 4. In Marsh Lot Sound, the usual room. Did you all come with questions? Did any of you come with questions? Audrey. The question is about the readings, and I will assume that you've read them all and know the general point of each of them. So I would make sure that you had gone over them and that you had a general idea about what they were describing, what they were explaining, and then that you could connect for each reading, you could interpret it using Bronfenbrenner, using a developmental perspective. So I won't ask incredibly detailed questions about each reading, and I won't ask you to guess which reading it was when I ask a question. So I'm more interested in your understanding of the concepts in the reading and your ability to interpret those concepts or translate them into a developmental framework. So, for example, if you're reading Honig's, and that's the long one, particularly long, on raising competent and responsible children, or whatever the title is, I always forget. She has a number of suggestions for parents and teachers about what it takes. And if you think about what she describes, there are probably 15 or 20 points that she describes as being important for children to develop competence. And each of those points potentially could be translated into developmental terms. What is she saying about the nature of the parent-child dyad, about joint activities, about the mesosystem? There are a couple of points about the macrosystem in that article. So what I would do is maybe quote something from that article and then ask you to interpret it. And that's an example. And you could then generalize that example to any of the readings. They're all talking about development or family structure or family systems or what goes on in the microsystem or where the family fits into society. And they're all supportive in one way or another of the perspective that I've been trying to brainwash you with. No. The question is whether it will be similar to the eco exam. There won't be the kind of objective pick this, pick that kind of question because we don't need to do that because you already have that. Some of the content from Bronfenbrenner will be asked in other ways. There'll be some multiple choice questions on everything, lecture and readings and the Bronfenbrenner We don't want to have to score anything by hand that isn't essay, so we won't ask any of those because everything we'll ask will be in the multiple choice format, so we can grade it on the score it on the Scantron, or it'll be short answer or essay, so that we can read those. And there won't be a lot of those, but there will be some. An opportunity for you to, for example, interpret. I might give you, as I said, a quote from one of the readings and expect you to understand how that quote fits into the reading, not exactly. I'll tell you who said it, but I won't do any secrets like that. No mind games. But the quote, and or maybe two, and ask you to explain in your own words how they would fit. Why these would be good for a child, for example, and then I would expect you to use Bronfenbrenner's concepts to explain how they would be good. I might give you longer essays, asking you to explain some phenomenon, or if you were, I'm making these up off the top of my head, if you were going to explain why spanking is not good for kids, how would you do that using Bronfenbrenner's concepts? So you'd want to be thinking about what spanking means within the parent-child relationship in that dyad, what it does to the affect. So it'll be multiple choice and short answer and short essay. And normally I would look to Julie to make sure that I'm right, but she's having fun today. That's why she's not here. She has the afternoon off. Her parents are in town. They're playing. You don't need to know the hypotheses by number, and you don't need to be able to quote them, but you should have a pretty good sense of what you wrote in assignment 5. That's why we did assignment 5. So you think, okay, these are the characteristics of the ecosystem that are good for development, and they reflect the hypotheses. The only way I would do something like that, I would give you the hypothesis and give you 2 or 3 examples and ask you which one best illustrates the operation of that hypothesis. But in that case, I wouldn't ask you to recall the hypothesis. I'll give it to you and say, here are 3 or 4 family situations or child rearing situations. Which one of these best applies to that? So again, it's interpretation and application. One of your classmates just walked by. That way. Do that. You should know that basic stuff, but I'm assuming now that you passed the eco exam that you do know that stuff and will never forget it. It's kind of like riding a bicycle. You've been over it so many times that it's in there. You'll discover it coming out. But yeah, you might want to go back over it. I would reread my assignment 5 just as a refresher. That would probably be the best way. If you did that well, it would be the best way to review the Bronfenbrenner stuff. Review notes, things we've talked about in lecture, and I would go back to the beginning of that, things like, what kind of romantic dyad would you like to participate in? What kinds of problems do people have? what happens, how would you understand moving in with a romantic partner and your first cohabiting experience, other than it's a sin and it's dangerous and you shouldn't do it? How would Bronfenbrenner see it? What does marriage mean? I wouldn't ask it that generally. Put that on tape. Yeah, good question. Or on hard drive. Have you been applying this stuff? Does it make sense to you as you look at your parents' relationship, your own relationships? Do you think of the dyad and the characteristics of the relation?
My boyfriend James. I always think about. He's like really frustrated.
Have you taken HDFS 65 yet?
No. Yeah.
Yeah. He'll really hate that one. Make him take it with you. If you stick with HDFS, the last course is 260, which is the family system, family ecosystem. There it's not just the boyfriends, but the families that worry about the course, because people do case studies on their own families. I've been reading them, and just fascinating. It's applying Bronfenbrenner and other systems approaches to understanding one's own family. They're fun. Boyfriends should like it. They should like the fact that you're taking this course. You're going to help them become better partners. Someday, a rejected, jilted boyfriend is going to come gunning for me. Because I've been used as the excuse for breaking up the relationship. So I should offer a course for the boyfriends, the ex-boyfriends.
You know, I always talk about it. It's like, it's getting ridiculous. Yeah.
Is he reading Galinsky?
I actually read out
Why? He doesn't want to know about people.
He's overwhelming, yeah.
Oh. Scary. Yeah. Okay. Human development majors should only marry other human development majors. Problem is, there are so few men in human development. Can I put you on the spot?
Go for it.
Go for it. What is it, how do you, applying Bronfenbrenner, understand your boyfriend's attitude toward this course?
I just feel like...
You have a different way of understanding it than you had before, different concepts to apply. So you're developing a more differentiated and valid view of relationships by thinking about these concepts. But one of the difficulties with that is that if the partner has not been studying the same concepts, then your view of the world is becoming different. As yours becomes more differentiated and valid, and the partner doesn't have the same concepts, then we we sometimes have difficulty when somebody else understands something in ways that we don't. And that can be a problem. And that can motivate partners to do the reading and take the course and ask you about it. But if you think about what it does to the relation, there is that general piece of your view of the world, the VW, the view of the world. You should see my notes when I write about this stuff. The VW, the view of the world. But as you think about the specificity of the relationship, one of the issues in having the contemporaneous concepts that the other person doesn't have is that it restricts the reciprocity. When both partners understand the same concepts to apply to relationships, you increase the reciprocity. So that's a problem. It reduces the ability to talk about relationships because you have a different language. And as you understand relationships differently and in a more sophisticated fashion, it gives you more power. And I'll quote, there was an anthropologist years ago who did some wonderful work filming mothers and children and fathers and children. It was terrific work. And we had him here many years ago as a guest. He's no longer living. But we had an open session with a group of our majors. Hi. And what he ended up doing was talking about divorce because his wife had just left him. And so we wanted him to talk about his work, but he needed to process the fact that he was in the process of getting a divorce. And one of the things that he said has always stuck with me, that the thing that really shocked him when his wife left is that he discovered that she'd been planning it. She knew exactly what she was going to do. She had her future laid out for her. She knew how to marshal her friends and her support and take care of herself. And he didn't know diddly squat about taking care of himself. And he said, the problem in our society for men is that women know everything that's important. Men know about building bridges and driving cars and making maps and playing football, but women know about people. And it had suddenly occurred to him that that knowing about people gave women power. And what you have is an imbalance in power if one person has a more sophisticated view of relationships than the other. So if the partners are smart, they'll study it up so that they can rebalance the power and know what you do about relationships. So in a really, really healthy relationship with a guy who's not overwhelmed by being a student and his own work, he'll spend a lot of time finding out what you're learning. So you can share the same view of the world, become more reciprocal, person will start to analyze things and develop equal power. But what happens with some people is that as the reciprocity goes down because they don't understand what's going on in the relationship in the same way, and the other person gains power, they use other techniques for trying to regain the power. And if you look at Gottman's work that you read, Carrera and Gottman, talking about stonewalling and disrespect, those are potential responses that people have when somebody else has a different view of the world. So one of the things that we do to our partners sometimes when they're smarter than we are about something is we put them down. And that's a way of exercising our own power. We make fun of them. We try to prove that we know something better than they do. We compete to try to rebuild the power. And that's a dynamic that happens in relationships a lot. But from a Brontemporanarian perspective, what you're doing is trying to gain back the reciprocity, but it becomes negative. You're trying to balance the power by proving that you're powerful. The positive way to do that is to find out what the other person knows and celebrate it and ask them to use it and share it. And in a healthy relationship, people do that. In the other kind of relationship, they fight the other person. A personal example, my father-in-law, my first father-in-law, had a law degree he'd gotten at night. He never went to college. Back in the old days, you could just go to law school. And he did that. He never practiced law, but he had the degree. His wife, my mother-in-law, had a bachelor's degree and a master's in social work. And when she was doing something that he didn't understand and he wanted to become powerful again, he would put her down. And one of the ways he would put her down was, "I can't believe you have a master's degree. You couldn't possibly. You must have bought that master's degree. You can't be that smart." He would put her down rather than trying to figure out what she was doing. It was unpleasant to be around. And the impact on the affect in the relationship depends on which way people go. How do you rebalance the power and the reciprocity? If you take the negative route and the affect goes down, then you're on that cascade that Gottman describes of breaking up. You become disrespectful and then you fall apart. If you take the more relationship building ways, then the affect improves because you're teaching each other. It's a developmental dyad that both people are learning in. And when you look at healthy relationships, one of the features of them is that people learn from each other and they celebrate that. They love the fact that they're learning from each other. And they want it. That's a reciprocity in that that allows you to respect the other person and that person's power as a learner and as a teacher. It's hard knowing about human development and family stuff because you discover so many other people don't. And sometimes they resent it. I love it when we have engineering students in the class. How many of you are engineering students? Because it's a very, very different way of thinking. And sometimes they absolutely love it. And sometimes they go, "Huh?" So we want your boyfriend to love the fact that you're in this course. And we want him to read what you read and talk to you about it. See how it applies. Other questions or observations? You are using this stuff in your relationships. Yeah. For Galinsky, you should know the stages and particularly why each stage comes about. That is why you move from one stage to the other. What are the issues that drive that stage? And what is the child doing that's driving that stage? And Galinsky explains those pretty well. A lot of her major concepts are in italics. She makes it real easy to go through the chapters and pick out the main points. But you should be able, if asked, to elaborate on each of the stages. How does the nurturing, what kinds of issues come up in the nurturing stage? What kinds of issues come up in the departure stage? You should have a few concepts in mind to connect to each of them. What else is worrying you? Macro system? Everybody's comfortable with the notion of macro system?
Can we just go over, like,
Yep.
You can go over.
What's the ecosystem? Run from Runner actually didn't define that. And I think I haven't either. Ecosystem is the whole thing. All of it. The whole thing. So your ecosystem is the entire environment, all the settings, all of the relationships, the culture, all of it. So when you talk about a person's ecosystem, that's the most general term you can use. And then what Bronfenbrenner has done is break that down into the smallest systems, the microsystems, and every setting has a microsystem in it. So that's the smallest, and it contains the roles, relationships, and activities. So the roles, relationships, and activities are the proximal processes, the connections among people, the expectations. And then the various settings get connected to each other to create the mesosystem, or the middle system. So the mesosystem is the set of relationships that connect microsystems or settings. And specifically the ones that the developing person actually engages in. And this is really review. And then there are other settings that connect to microsystems that the developing person is in, but the developing person doesn't actually go into them, so that's the exo, on the outside system. That the relationships among settings that connect the settings that developing person doesn't participate in connects those to all of the others. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any setting where something happens that is affected by something that goes on in one of your microsystems, or that affects something that goes on. So it's two ways. It can be either direction or both. And then the macro system is the most abstract. Refers to the similarities across those other systems. So if you see in the settings in a particular community that the settings all share some common features, the fact that those settings share common features is the macro system. Includes those consistencies or commonalities and the beliefs that we use to support those. So as a very simple example, if you look at microsystem settings that are households, they're likely to have husbands and wives in them. And so you think about a family and its setting, the microsystem, the household, two of the roles are husband and wife. And that's going to be true for millions of settings in this culture. If there's going to be a husband and a wife or a former spouse. And there's a whole set of beliefs about when people can live together, what they ought to be to each other, support for that. Our federal government has an initiative to strengthen marriage. And so we're saying that those two roles, husband and wife, in families, in the settings, ought to be strong relationships. And if you want a fun exercise, I haven't tried it yet, but it's fun to think about what a weak husband-wife relationship is. We've read Gottman, so you have some sense of that. You have reciprocity, power, and affect issues that you could apply to that. And then if you were a Bronfenbrennerian, what would you do in public policy to strengthen marriages? The federal government isn't interested in strengthening one marriage. Maybe George and Barbara will strengthen theirs. But, I don't know, maybe it doesn't need strengthening. But how would you change things to strengthen millions of marriages? That's a macro system question, because it's about how we do things, what our laws are, what our policies are, and to set out to use public policy and legislation to strengthen marriages. It just begs for a developmental analysis. And that's the kind of thing that Bronfenbrenner was interested in. How do we do that? How can you improve a relationship by what you do to change public policy? And that means changing the mesosystem. Maybe you do something to improve the connections between work and home. Maybe you have more flexible scheduling. Maybe you change the microsystem of the school. Maybe you change the curriculum so that everybody gets taught relationships skills. And then when they grow up, they're better partners. Maybe you require a test for marriage. It's those consistencies, the fact that you will have a pair of roles, that make up the macro system. And the society will support particular kinds of roles. We'll give you a tax break if you're married. We'll allow you to be responsible for each other's debts if you're married. We'll allow you to, for one of you who's employed, to provide health insurance for both of you if you're married. Those are macro system policies and consistencies across different kinds of employers, different kinds of states, different kinds of couples. They have those consistencies. Well, each person exists in a macro system. And so you have one. Some of them are clearer and more consistent than others. So in an undeveloped culture, in a traditional community, there may be very limited roles, and all the households may be structured the same way. And that's the way the world is. In a more diverse culture, a more developed culture, you may have more diversity in the consistencies. So in New York City, you're going to have different kinds of households, and that's going to be connected to the cultural origins of people. So you have maybe Asian American households may be different from African American households, may be different from Caribbean households. You have those more diversity, and that's part of what we mean by multicultural, is that you have a macro system that reflects a variety of ways of doing things. The reason Bronfenbrenner, taking that another step farther, the reason Bronfenbrenner encourages in one of the hypotheses multicultural experience, being in other cultures and other macrosystems, is because it's very helpful to understand that the way things are done in your household and in your community is not the only way to do it. But if you believe it is the only way to do it, then everybody else is foreign and wrong. And that's the basis for prejudice and discrimination and ignorance, because you don't have a valid view of the world that you live in, which is much more diverse than that. So Bronfenbrenner's view is that the more multicultural experience you have, the more you understand the macro system, the more you understand that, in fact, it can be changed, it can be different. So thinking about changing the macro system to promote human development, using public policy, for example, you're not going to do that if you think that things are perfect the way they are, or you can't conceive of them being different. But a valid view of the world says nothing is perfect and we might be able to improve the way we do things. And we look to other cultures for suggestions about how to do that. We look much more specifically at that in the social context of human development in the fall. I know, and I've said in the book and I've said in lecture, it's very difficult to wrap one's mind around the notion of macrosystem and to think about the consistencies. Some of the examples in the book, I think, are helpful. Let me give you another example. I mentioned in class, I'll pick up from the fact that I just mentioned, the fact that you have a representative democracy in the United States is a significant part of our macro system. It was a huge idea culturally, emerging way back as far as the Roman Senate and probably farther back than that. But in Western society, the French Revolution was a big step in changing the macro system, replacing the king with a representative democracy, and it's a huge difference. In a representative democracy, you elect somebody to represent you so that you pull together representatives of different people into a body like a legislature, because you can't get everybody in the country together to agree on what the laws ought to be. So everybody elects somebody to represent them, and those people meet to create the laws. And the notion in a democracy is that everybody gets to vote, and everybody gets one vote, and you figure out some way to be represented. That idea is so pervasive in our culture that we expect to have representative democracy everywhere we go. And we do. So if you look at your community, it probably had something like a town council. If you were in Vermont, you have a select board in your town. You have a legislature at the state level. You have a congressman, in our case Bernie Sanders, representing us in Washington, D.C. at that level. If you belong to an organization, it's likely to have a representative body. Pick them at random. I belong to the American Psychological Association. It represents 100,000 or so psychologists across the country. We elect representatives to the American Psychological Association Governing Council. They determine the policies of the association. You can't have 100,000 people sitting down together, so that's where the legislation is made. Any organization you belong to in Western society is likely to have a representative governing body that says, this is how we're going to operate. Whether it's a labor union or a professional organization, the American Medical Association, the American Bar Association, Education Association, name them, they all operate as representative democracies. People coming together for whatever reason, joining, voting, and going up. We expect it. It's part of our thinking that we expect that. In other cultures, they have no understanding of that. It simply wouldn't happen. There would not be a representative democracy. There wouldn't be voting for people to represent you. You might have a king who will appoint somebody to go find out what's wrong with you and come back and tell him, but you're not going to elect that person. That's a different macro system. I don't want to beat that one to death because we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about it. There will be some questions that will refer to the macro system. Okay, so the relationship between the ecosystem, micro, meso, exo, and macro is reasonably clear in your heads. The ecosystem is the whole thing. Every setting has a microsystem. The relationships among those microsystems is the mesosystem. The ones that you're not involved in are related through the exosystem. And the macrosystem is how they're similar across the various settings. Amazing to have basic five concepts that cover the whole world. There it all is. Your whole world. Right there. Kind of scary. What are you afraid we'll ask? Okay.
What are some of the situations that we're going to have to apply terms to? Like, is it going to be like divorce?
Yep. And anything we've talked about, the question is what kinds of situations would I expect you to be able to apply the concepts to? And any of the illustrations that we've used, divorce would be one, because we've talked about that. Parenting would be another, because that's what Galinsky is about. Honig's article is about that. Couple relationships, from dating to through divorce. I'm going to be able to think about that. We haven't really talked about cognitive development for kids or skills, but it would be helpful to keep in mind that as we look at activities, and particularly molar activities, that's what development is about in many ways. So Bronfenbrenner has some propositions that he's presented in the two articles that you had that he wrote. In the book there's a discussion of molar activities. That'll be thinking about how things become more complex and how engaging in an activity with somebody might influence your development. And how you engage in it might be important. The positive affect, you enjoy it, a lot of reciprocity. Those are the biggies. And using Galinsky and Bronfenbrenner together, you know, thinking about how things might change, for example, in family when a kid learns to walk. What happens? How would you describe it when a child goes to school for the first time? And what's that doing to the family? And what are the parents likely to be experiencing then? You think about the mesosystem. And what happens when a kid goes through puberty or brings a boyfriend home? Put on the Bronfenbrenner hat and think about it. Pretty wide open, really, but we tend to pick the things that I've actually talked about or we've read about to focus on. We've talked a little bit about abuse, not very specifically, a little bit. What haven't we talked about? Sibling order. Because you've had that reading and we talked about it. And the essence of sibling order is that you create different roles dependent on your place in the family. I like the idea that came up with, was it Wednesday, about thinking about how you would design a community so that affairs were not developmentally destructive. Fun to think about. Polygamy. Macrosystem different in Texas? Everything's different in Texas. Anybody from farther away than Texas? Where are you from?
Here.
Massachusetts. Is Hawaii different? Other than warmer. The skiing is lousy. Yeah, water skiing is pretty good. Lava skiing. You don't want to wipe out on lava. But every place in the United States, the macro system is very similar in fundamental ways. Representative democracy. Capitalist. Anything else? What? The exam? Is the exam long? Not particularly, no. I don't know whether it'll be painful or not. Is length related? No, probably not. There's a reality here. We can think about the microsystem of the class and the mesosystem that Julie and I occupy, and the molar activity that we designed for you, called an exam, has to be relatively congruent with the demands of our other settings. And part of the macro system of the university is that the registrar expects to have our grades on Monday the 15th. So we have to think about everything else we have to do, understand our whole ecosystem. So one of the things I do with Julie is figure out what else is going on in her life, look at what else I have going on in my life, and manage our ecosystems, hers and mine, in such a way that we can grade the exams, get the grades done, get them in, and get everything else done. So we're not motivated to give a really, really long, complex exam because she has a life, I need a life, we need sleep, we have other things we'd like to do. So it's a balancing act. Part of being competent in your world, the valid view, is understanding the other pressures and demands and what you have to do so you don't bite off more than you can chew. Someday I'll get there. Yeah.
I mean, I've done
very well for everything, and I don't see that you're going to have a problem. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, where did this come from?
Yeah. Yeah. That's an interesting question, and for those of you who are listening online, the question was, if you've done well on all the other things, is the exam going to have the potential to bring you down or raise you up? Is it going to be really different? And I hadn't thought about that. It's an interesting question. Two things occur to me. One is that for a lot of it, what we've tried to do in the six assignments is to build from basic concepts to application and creativity in the creation of rules. That's an application. So those have become more complex and more free and more individual. So if you've done well on all of those and you have a pretty good understanding of the Bronfenbrenner stuff and enough about parenting to be able to write the rules in a way that makes sense. But what we haven't done at all is examine you on specific lecture material or reading. So that part of it is going to be different. And it could be a problem for people who haven't done the reading. So people who haven't done the reading or come to lectures are going to find the exam is not going to help them. But my expectation is that most of the people who've done well on the six assignments have probably also been in lecture and have done the reading because they have a pretty good sense of how to cover everything in a course. So it would be interesting to take the total of points at this point and correlate it with exam performance, and that wouldn't be too hard for us to do. I'd never thought about doing that before. But my guess is that they're fairly closely correlated. And people who are doing well at this point are going to do well on the exam, too. But it could be different. You know, there could be a surprise. But the surprise would be not having thought about the readings.
Do you happen to know how many points, like, a cumulative amount would be as, like, a decent grade?
I'd have to look at the distribution at this point. Before assignment 6, the average was 90, and the top was maybe 112. Don't quote me, but something on that order. So anything above 90 is going to be some form of B or A. I haven't looked at the shape of the distribution closely enough to know, but probably 104, 105 is likely to be A range and up. Adding assignment 6 to that will change that distribution. Most people did assignment 6, and the average on that is probably going to be 30, high 20s or low 30s, something in that range. So if you add 30 to your score now and figure out where you'll be, the distribution will lengthen. But that would mean the top is going to be somewhere around, at this point, 140, 50. I'm adding 40 to 112. I get up to 150. And the average is going to be something like 120 now. And then the final is going to blow all of that because there'll be probably 100 points or so on the final. So that's a lot of points to add. But as I said, people who've done well now will probably do well in the final.
Do you know when they post grades, like final grades?
Final grades are posted on the registrar's website as soon as they come in, plus a few hours.
So probably like
we have to have them in by the 15th at noon or so. They get hundreds of courses being turned in at that time. So I wouldn't expect them before maybe Wednesday. But the registrar staff works very hard to get them in. I don't actually know physically how they enter them. They go in on a bubble form. So they do scan them. But I don't know how they connect people's names. I don't know how they work. Never occurred to me to ask. Once I turn them in, I'm sleeping, napping. But it used to take them a week or so because they did everything by hand, but now they'll probably be up Wednesday, Thursday at the latest, I would think. And you can just go in and get them if there's no hold on your account. Frustrating part is if there's a hold on your account because you have parking tickets you haven't paid, can't get your grades. Enough to think about for the weekend? Okay. Go think about it for the weekend. Lots of sleep.